in my...
Wait.
Oh, no!
You just got it everywhere.
Dom.
Worth it. Well, hi, guys. Welcome to...
Oh, no.
Gavinated Christian. So what's up, guys? I hope that y'all have had a great weekend, weeks, because this is coming up on Sunday. This is Saturday when we record this, but I hope you had a good week. We missed you guys last week, but it was crazy last week. There's just been a lot of things happening. It's just been a lot. So we're excited to be here in full swing. So anyways, guys, we're talking about the Ketuvim this week. Let us jump into the Ketuvim.
Lettuce. Like a salad.
Jump into the Ketuvim. So guys, the Ketuvim, what is the Ketuvim? This is the third and final part of the Tanakh. And if you don't remember what the Tanakh is, we'll review. It is the name of the Old Testament for the Jewish people. The Tanakh is an acronym for the three parts of the Old Testament, which is the Torah, the Nevi'im, and finally the Ketuvim. So the Ketuvim is the most diverse part of the Tanakh. And the Ketuvim is roughly translated as the writings. And basically that's what it is. So it's divided into three different parts, and not all of them have a name. And so the first part is the Books of Truth, is what Hebrew scholars call it. And it is Psalms, Proverbs, and Job. So the three big boys, or the Books of Truth. And then we got the five scrolls, which is Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther, which are also the big boys. And then lastly, we got history, question mark. Some people call it history. It doesn't actually have an official name, and so we'll just call it the history books, which is Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Ecclesiastes, and Chronicles. So all of the basically random stuff that they couldn't fit in the Torah and the Nevi'im has been stuffed here.
We're just gonna stick this here.
Yeah, for real. So basically that is what the background, there isn't a lot of background information on the Ketuvim. I'm gonna start off with Psalms, and Holly, just feel free to jump in wherever you feel led.
I can't really jump though because I'm laying.
Okay, well, you know what I mean. Okay. So, the Psalms is one of my favorite books in the Bible, because I'm an emotional human being, and so is David, the author of the Psalms, and so I just connect really well with him on a spiritual level. And also, David would totally be an Enneagram 4 for all you Enneagram nerds out there, 112%, he's an Enneagram 4. So, the Greek name for Psalms is Psalmos, which means Psalms, like,
what? Oh my gosh.
So, it's really fun. And then the Hebrew translation is Tehillim, which means praises. And evidently, the Psalms is composed of different songs, praises, thanksgivings, needs, laments, etc. It's very diverse in writing. And it's majorly written by David. But there's also parts where the songs of Korah.
Okay, Korah was the one that, way back in Moses' day, he decided that he was going to get his band of brothers together and rebel against Moses and be like, yo, we don't want to do this, so we're going to do it a different way. And then God said, well, I think I'm a little bit more important than you. And then he opened up the earth and swallowed Korah and all of his followers and his family and everyone that was in the rebellion. Literally, the earth opened and they fell in. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But what's more interesting is that his sons, who I don't know, I guess assume were like too young then maybe, to really like know anything, were saved. And so there's something cool about their lineage that I don't really remember at the moment, but I do know that they ended up being part of the people that were working like in the temple and stuff that David appointed.
Oh, that's cool.
And so even though they came from this family of rebellion, they ended up back in the line of like Jesus. And so they wrote some of the Psalms, and I think that's really interesting.
It's so cool. Again, it shows how God redeems and restores even generationally. So the sons of Korah also wrote some Solomon and Moses, and there are lots of unknown authors in the Psalms. So it's a very diverse like themes and also very diverse authors, and so it's full of lots of poetry and a really great place if you're in a position of not knowing how to pray, not knowing what to pray, or you just feel like you need to connect to scripture in a very deep, meaningful way. The Psalms is a really great place to go. And so The Psalms itself is divided into five books. It's a huge, huge book. So there's 150 chapters. And so it's divided into five books. And so the first book is Psalms 1 through 41. And it's, that book is almost fully written by David. Only Psalm 10 and 33 are not written by David. And these are prayers from a situation of distress and confidence that God can only save. And so it's a lot of, God, my enemy is coming to hit me. Help me, God. It's like basically that's the theme. It's very much David in distress. Enemies are coming. It's a lot of these are written when David was running from Saul. And yeah, really, really cool stuff. So then Psalms 42 through 71 makes up book two. And so this introduces the first Psalms by the sons of Korah and the next Davidic collection. And so lament and distress are also dominant in this book, but now it's a communal cry. It's less of Lord help me, I am alone. It's Lord help us, we are alone. It's more of a communal place because the Israelites are a very communal culture. Neighbors are very important to them and family and things like that. They're a lot more communal than us in the U.S. So this is a very communal cry of God, you need to help us as a group. And so really, really cool. So book three is Psalm 73 through 89, and this is a very dark tone. This is kind of where the Psalms go from the constant ray of hope in the darkness to just dark, basically. And so a lot of these Psalms question the justice of God before seeing the light in God's presence, and it's just very dark, very solemn, very sad. And so it kind of shows the lamenting character of the Bible and how important that is, which I will get into in a later book of the Bible. And then Psalm 90 through 106 is the first response to the problems raised in the third book. And so it's kind of like book three and then book four is the response to book three. And so it reminds the worshiper that God was active on Israel's behalf from the very beginning. And kind of the overarching theme is that the Lord reigns and the Lord is good. And so it kind of sheds that hope that wasn't there in book three, which I think is really, really cool how there's always a restorative theme in the Bible no matter what. And then book five is the closing of the Psalms, and it contains the longest psalm in the longest chapter in the Bible, Psalm 119, which is how many verses? 180, I can look really fast.
I don't remember.
Which is 176 verses, which is a lot. And so this book kind of shows that God does answer prayer. There's a part where it's called the Hallelujah Psalms. And it just kind of celebrates the value of the instruction and the law of the Lord. And so the Psalms is a really great place to go to when you're needing encouragement, to kind of relate to people who are in distress, and to just be able to find good words and good ways to praise and adore the Lord, which is, I think, is really cool. So Proverbs, Psalms and Proverbs kind of go hand in hand in wisdom literature. And poetry in the Bible. And so whenever someone really talks about Psalms, you kind of hear them also bring up Proverbs in some way. They're just kind of like besties in that way, you know. So most of this book is closely linked with Solomon. And wisdom is very important to Solomon. Israel kind of looks at him as the wisest man alive. And so it's kind of was linked to Solomon, Proverbs in itself. And so this is kind of divided up into three sections. There's chapters 1 through 9, which is the introduction to Proverbs. And so it kind of begins in Proverbs, like linking it to Solomon, as we already iterated. And so it says, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, is the very first verse in this. And so the idea of wisdom is Kukma, I think is what it is in Hebrew. I totally just butchered that pronunciation, but it's spelled K-H-O-K-H-M-A-H. And it's not just mental wisdom, but it's also having a skill and applying that knowledge to your everyday life. And so these Proverbs that we read are not just, oh, I'm going to remember this. It's, let me live this out. Let me live this wisdom out. And because wisdom is incredibly important to the Lord, this entire book is all about wisdom. And so kind of talks about the first chapters is a father kind of talking to his son. It's kind of a father-son relationship, and here's what you need to do in your life, and here's my wisdom I'm passing down to you, which kind of, again, shows that really important dynamic relationship between the father and the son, how God is our father, and we are his son or daughter, and he is passing that wisdom down to us. And so it kind of talks about how the fear of the Lord is important, and we need to be in reverence and awe of him and humbling ourselves before the Lord. All very, very important. And then we got chapters 10 through 29, which is kind of comprised of the hundreds of ancient proverbs. So it's just a lot of Proverbs of Solomon. It's just literally like verses over and over again talking about how important wisdom is. And it kind of talks about all the things, marriage, debt, alcohol, relationships, sex. It literally talks about everything. So they're just kind of one-liners that are really important with wisdom. There's lots of really great info here. And then we got chapters 30 and 31, which is like the last two chapters of Proverbs. And so the first one, chapter 30, talks about Agur, which is a model leader of Proverbs. And it's basically talking about how he doesn't know where to find wisdom, blah, blah, blah. And it basically is revealed to him that the wisdom is found in the scriptures. It's found in the Torah. It's found in the Nevi'im, the prophets. Those kind of things is where wisdom is accumulated. And so Agur, something like that, is basically learns that wisdom comes through scriptures. So he is like the model child of Proverbs. It's like we need to also find our wisdom from the scriptures. And then Lemuel basically talks about in chapter 31, right before it gets into the women of noble character, he talks about how his wisdom was passed down from his father, passed down from his family to him, and then talks about how there is the woman of noble character and what she looks like. And earlier in Proverbs, there is the lady wisdom is talked about. And lady wisdom is incredibly important to the Proverbs and basically is characterizes a woman who is always present where wisdom is carried out. And so when there are people being generous or abstaining from sexual impurity or whatever it is, she is there. And so this is a really cool, comparison to lady wisdom and the woman of noble character, how they are almost the same. And so kind of talks about how the right wife is a person who carries out all these things. Proverbs 31 is like one of those like highlight verses for women, I think, that she's really popular. And so that's Proverbs. Really, really cool, really good stuff. It's a really great hand-in-hand book to read along with Psalms and just to read like one chapter a day. Yeah, so then we get into the Job. Anything you want to add? Sorry. Nope, I'm just fine. We got Job, one of the most depressing books of the Bible. Legit. Like, these are all the really sad ones that we're going to go over today. So we got one of the most depressing books of the Bible, right? So basically, this consists of Job and his friends, and it was not originally written by Job himself. We don't know who the author is. Some people think it is Job's, one of the new friends that comes in at the very end. Oh, where is it? What's his name? Elihu. Some people believe it is him that writes it, but we don't really know. It's set in the land of Uz, and all the characters are non-Israelites. And so it's just a very unique book in that way. So it's divided into three parts as well, which is really nice. So there's chapters 1 through 2, which is the prologue. And so basically in this, it introduces who Job is and kind of tells that Job is a man of noble character. He's a great guy. He's loves Jesus, or not, Jesus isn't there. Loves God, like all this kind of stuff. And he's a great dude. And so then it kind of flashes in chapter 2 to the heavenly realms and kind of talks about how there is the Satan, which is Satan, which means accuser in Hebrew, who is sitting before God, or standing before God, and is accusing God of blessing Job too much. And he's like, oh, the only reason why Job loves you is because you've provided him with money and animals and a great family and just like have constantly kept him healthy, so that's the only reason why he loves you. And so God, who trusts in Job, his faithfulness toward him, is like, well, you can go and you can attack him. And so this kind of sets us back a little bit, and we're like, excuse me, God, like, why would you like do that? Why would you punish this man who is loves you and is faithful to you? And kind of produces the question of why do bad things happen to good people? And what's interesting is that question is never answered in this book. Never explicitly says this is why at all. And so it leaves us questioning and making us trust God no matter what happens. And so the second part, which is chapters 3 through 37, is basically this these cycles, right? And so Job speaks, and then a friend speaks, and then Job responds, and then a friend responds to Job's response, and then Job responds to his friend's response, which was his response to him, which was him answering the friend. all this stuff. It's really confusing and long. But there's three different cycles. And so the first cycle is chapters 3 through 14, and it's kind of proposing the question of, is God just? It's kind of this back and forth of, is God just, whatever. This is after God allows Satan to, or the Satan, to decimate Job. And so he is sick, his family all dies, his farm all goes away, he doesn't have any money, he's literally alone with his friends, whatever. This is back and forth thing of, is God just? Is he not? And the second cycle, which is chapters 15 through 21, it's, does God run the universe on justice? So not just, is God just, but does God run the world with justice? And then cycle 3, which is chapters 22 through 28, is, how is Job's suffering to be explained? And so Job's argument is that he's an innocent man, that he did not do this huge, giant sin, which is, quote-unquote, supposed to be the blame for all this. He is innocent. He's an innocent man. And that his suffering is not divine justice. He then accuses God by saying that God doesn't run the world on justice and accuses that God is unjust. So he's kind of, you know, he's still like, he still is running after the Lord and still trusting the Lord, but he's also at this point where he's like, okay, well, why is this happening to me if I did not commit this huge sin? And so Job's three friends that are chilling with him, that are meanies, basically saying that God is just and God does run the world on justice, but that Job must have done something and must have sinned. And so basically they're accusing Job of sinning and start coming up at the end of this, like, end of this little, like, section of, they're like, oh yeah, he must have sinned, whatever. And so basically Job at the very end of this section protests against God, and he goes through this really crazy emotional cycle, and then basically has like this last statement where he's like, okay, God, I want you to show up and answer, like, and defend yourself, like, why are you doing this? And so Elihu, after Job, like, says, God, I want you to come here and, like, speak for yourself, Elihu argues that God is just and that God runs the world according to justice, and that suffering may be a warning to avoid future sin because it builds character, but God is not wrong. And so Elihu kind of comes in out of nowhere. We're kind of like, bro, where'd you come from? He comes in and he's like, I think all y'all wrong. Like, here's what I think is the answer. So it's very interesting how all that be
is
happening.
Is that how he talked?
Yeah.
I hope so.
So then the third section is chapters 38 through 41, and it basically, God comes in and he gives Job a virtual tour of the universe, right? So basically he's like, look at the stars, look at the planets and the oceans, like, look at all the things that I am watching over myself. I am paying very careful detail to each of these things and also to your life. And he's like, are you doing this? Like, were you there when I created everything? Are you sitting and watching over everything in detail? You are not. Job needs to broaden his horizons. Job is so focused on this one path, this very small section, which is of his life, and not looking at the broader scheme of things and the broader detail of, oh, there's a lot more going on than just what's happening to me. And so this is kind of the place where we'd be like, okay, well, maybe God will answer the question of, like, why did God actually allow this to happen to Job? And he doesn't. And so basically God is like, I need you to trust in my wisdom and my character because I am just, I am God, I am perfect, and I am looking very carefully over your life and also everything else. And so, basically, the last chapter, which is, I guess, his own, like, little segment, is that Job responds with utter humility, and he's like, you know what, God, you're right, and I'm really sorry, and I'm wrong, and whatever, and basically is kind of like this conclusion where God states that Job's friends were wrong, and that Job did not sin, and basically honors Job's wrestling. The way that Job presented all of his inner turmoil and inner thoughts to God and said, God, I'm wrestling with all this kind of stuff, was something that God loved and something that God honored and something that we need to even do, even though there's a lot that happens in our life that is confusing and makes us angry at God and makes us frustrated with God. He wants us to come to him with that kind of stuff, and so the way that Job handled all that was a really, really cool way. And so next we have Song of Songs. Basically, Song of Songs is a very interesting book. It's kind of like one of those, like, very obscure books, like, which I'll talk about. It's a very, like, lovey-dovey.
It's kind of rated R.
It's kind of rated R because it's a lot about sex. And so we're going to briefly
go. It's like all about sex.
Yeah. So, basically, the Song of Songs is possibly written by Solomon. We're not 100% sure. But basically, it is the wrestling between a woman and a man before they I guess, are married. And it's kind of like a, I'm longing to be with you and you're not here and whatever. It's like a very, just a very like romantic, like people who are desiring to be married so that they're able to have sex and like all this kind of stuff. And it, and even though it's weird and gross and blah, blah, it does kind of go into just how important covenants are, especially with the person you are supposed to marry. It's, as someone like me who is a hopeless romantic, because that's who I am, it's a beautiful picture of a man and a wife who are about to become one. And it kind of shows the sacredness of marriage and why the Lord has set, like, you know, sex, like, for marriage and for marriage only and things like that. And so it's just a really cool way of, like, showing what love is and what love is supposed to be. And, yeah, that's basically it. There's 8 chapters, and they're all just very repetitive. And, yeah, I don't... That's it! Yay! Song of Songs! What?
I just am thinking about... Do we know that Solomon wrote it? Because I feel like it wouldn't make sense that Solomon wrote it.
Because he had so many wives.
Because he had like 800 wives.
700, 800 wives, yeah.
Anyways, sorry, that's my brain.
So, Song of Songs, very self-explanatory. Next, we got Ruth.
Ruth. What a good story.
Ruth is so good.
What a great story.
I did a paper on Ruth, and it was so good. Like, I loved writing it, and I just love Ruth. It's a really, really great story. And so, it's very short. And what's interesting is that the author of Ruth, which we don't know who it is, really don't mention God. God is mentioned in the story by the characters themselves, but God, by the author, is not mentioned at all. So basically, a quick overview of the story of Ruth. It's 4 chapters long, and it's really, really chill. Basically, there is this father and Naomi. And Naomi and the father give birth to 4 sons, and the father dies, and these 4 sons marry women. So these sons marry women, Ruth and Orpah?
No, it's like Orpah, but not. It's like Orpah.
Or something like that. And so then the husbands, they all die. And so it's just Orpah, whatever her name is, Ruth, and Naomi. And so the life of a widow after her husband dies is very, very difficult. And so Naomi encourages these 2 daughter-in-laws of hers to go back home. And so Orpah, whatever her name is, leaves. She's not important. And then Ruth is very loyal to Naomi and is basically like, dude, I will go where you go. I will whatever. What is the line? Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And so Naomi's like, hooray. And so they go to Israel. And basically, Naomi changes her name to Mara, which means bitter, and that's all that happens in chapter 1. Chapter 2 is that Ruth and Naomi are trying to figure out what they're going to eat, all the fun stuff. And so Ruth begins picking grain in a field of a man named Boaz. What is so funny?
Oh, this is the way you're explaining this. It's really funny.
Well, I want them to be entertained.
I'm sorry. I'm entertained.
Okay. So Ruth begins picking grain in a field of a man named Boaz, who is a hunky-hunky, you know. And he is a man of noble character, is what he's described as. And so, which interesting is that Ruth finds out that Boaz is one of her relatives from a distance. And you guys, just so we know, this is back in ancient times. So marrying your relative was actually a good thing in
now,
ancient times.
It's
now,
a, no,
it's
no.
not. We don't do this. Okay.
Full stop.
Just had to clarify. Nope. So basically, Boaz shows her generosity and is like, of course, you may pick in this field, like bubbles kind of stuff, all this kind of stuff, whatever. And so Ruth comes back to Naomi and is like, dude, I met this really cool dude named Boaz, and that's where I got all this food. And they figure out that he is the redeemer of the family. He is going to restore the family. And in cultural practice, if you were a super widow, there was a redeemer in the family to help you restore and be able to make money and have land, because the life of a widow was really hard. And so they were like, Boaz, it's him. Ah! And so basically Naomi is like, Ruth, you have to go convince him to marry you. So Ruth begins showing Boaz that she is available to be married. She's like, you know, flirting with him or whatever. So she basically sits at his feet and is like, Boaz, will you please marry me? Because we need you to be a restorative person, and also you're a hunka-hunka man of noble character. And of course Boaz is like, of course I will marry you, Ruth, because I see that you are a woman of God and you are loyal and all the good stuff. And he calls Ruth a woman of noble character, very similar to the Proverbs 31 woman of noble character. And basically says, let's wait until the next day to get married. So then Basically, Boaz figures out that there is a man that is closer in relation to Ruth than he is like, hey, is it okay if I marry this person? And the guy's like, sure, whatevs. And basically acquires the property and marries Ruth, making Boaz very, very loyal to the family. And it's basically the reversal of all the tragedy that happened in chapter one. It's very cool how if you kind of take all the chapters and lay them out next to each other, it's just a very cool, like, similar story on both sides. So it's like, all this tragedy happened? Well, guess what? It's reversed in chapter four. And a very similar thing happens in chapters two and three. And so it's really cool just to see how God's providence is at work all the moments in this story. Even though he is not mainly mentioned, he's still just really cool. So that's the crash course on Ruth.
That was a good...
Two more for me. Okay, we got Lamentations. Okay, so lots of people believe that because Jeremiah was the weeping prophet, many people believe that he also wrote Lamentations, but it is not... We don't be knowing that for a fact yet, but people believe it. So, basically, the Lamentations are five poems from an anonymous author who many people believe to be Jeremiah, reflecting the siege of Jerusalem and the exile, which is all the catastrophe that happened. This was talked about a lot in 2 Kings. And so, basically, God was like, Israelites, y'all sucking it up right now. So I'm gonna exile y'all, and it's gonna be a really big mess. And so this is basically the aftermath of all that and the emotional trauma that all these people have gone through because they sucked in the first place. So lamenting poems, which very similar to the style of Psalms, lamenting poems are a form of protest. They're a form of processing emotion and then a place to voice confusion. And so these kind of poems are given a sacred dignity to human suffering because the way that these lamenting poems are kind of laid out is very similar to how Job responded to his own emotional turmoil. He laid it all before God, even though it was kind of a weeping pile of mess. He was like, God, I'm still giving you this. And so God honors these lamenting poems and the laments in Psalms. And lamenting is a very important practice that the Lord has given us to do with him. And so basically there are five chapters, and chapters 1-4 are all written in acrostic pattern, which means that there is each sentence is the first letter of, or is like a different letter of the Greek alphabet, which is, or the Hebrew alphabet, which is 22 letters long. And so it's really, really cool how it is. And so basically chapter one talks about Lady Zion's grief and shame. And it's kind of a picture of a person who is wailing in the streets because she feels awful and all these things, and that no one comes to comfort her, and she calls upon the Lord to notice her distress. Basically, the city's destruction can only be expressed as death and as a funeral because of how great the destruction is. And so then chapter 2 is a call of Jerusalem and God's wrath. It's basically the author acknowledging that God's wrath was just and that it was valid because the Israelites sucked it up earlier. And it's basically asking the Lord to show compassion on them and forgive them and to bring restoration within all of them. Chapter 3 is called the Suffering One, and basically it's a huge lament. It is a crazy, crazy lamenting, very, very dark. This is the darkest chapter in the book, but shows the only hope in the book, which I want to read for y'all, which is in verses 22 and 24, which I think is so beautiful. Oops. It says, yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those who hope in him, to the one who seeks him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. And so it's the only hope in this chapter in the book after all this sadness. So, huge lament, very sad. Then chapter 4, we got the Siege of Jerusalem, which is basically comparing what the past was like before the exile and then now what it is. It's representing the destruction of everything and just major contrasting all the things. And then chapter 5 breaks the acrostic poetry because the poet cannot hold his crap together because he is so emotional, all the things. And so it's basically a cry for a communal prayer for God's mercy. And it's a long list of the different people who are devastated by the destruction of the city. And it's like, God, like everyone, we need to ask God to remember us. We need to cry out to him and be like, God, help us. Bola. So Lamentations, all the sad, very lamenting, very cry, all the things. Last one that I'm doing Ecclesiastes. Where is Ecclesiastes in my Bible? So I just recently finished reading this, and it's super interesting. And so basically there are two different voices in this wisdom literature book of the Bible. There's the author of the book who wrote the book, and then there is the teacher who is talking about how everything is hevel. So hevel is, in our English versions, is meaningless, but hevel is not necessarily meaningless. It's more, the Hebrew word for hevel is hevel, and it is means to vapor, smoke, how life is temporary, fleeting, it's an enigma, and it's a paradox. Basically, life is quick, it is fast, and when we try to go and reach and grab it, it is gone before we can even realize it. It's like chasing after the wind, which is what the teacher kind of talks about there. And so the author's basic goal is to target all the ways that we try to create meaning apart from God, and there is a lot of them. So the two main like things that the teacher talks about is time and death, and how time will erase us and everything we care about. One of the big pictures is like you can go and climb a huge mountain and it won't care, and the mountain was there many, many years before you, and the mountain will stay many, many years after you. It's basically like no one will remember you in 100 years, but that mountain will still be there. And so time will erase us, everything they care about. And then the death is the equalizer. Death kills the wise, he kills the foolish, it kills the poor and the rich. Death will like at some point kill us all in ways that we don't even understand. And so it destroys our idea about career and pleasure, and that all is hevel. It's basically all does not matter at the end of the day. It really has no make or break effort, and if we focus too much on those things, then we will be living a life hevel. It shows that living with wisdom and the fear of the Lord can be hevel too. It does not guarantee a good life. Living with wisdom and fear of the Lord does not promise you that your life will be easy. If anything, it will probably make it a lot harder. It's not meaningless, but it's an enigma. And so how do you live life in the midst of hevel? You accept it. You know that everything in our life is not in our control, and we need to enjoy the gifts of God. Like the small things like friendships or a sunny day or whatever it is that brings you joy, you enjoy that. You don't focus so much on the bigger picture, but on the small gifts that the Lord provides with you each and every single day. And it needs to become a posture of totally trusting in God, and not as we all think to be. Like, I may sit here and be like, well, my life should go like this and this and this because I deserve it and things like that, when that's not the reality whatsoever. We need to just trust that the Lord will provide, and he will get us through, and he will speak to us in ways that we don't even understand. And so the author brings it together as a conclusion that the teacher's words, which may be difficult when they kind of gives it as like a shepherd and we are the sheep. When the teacher pokes us with his long stick, it hurts at first because the words that he is giving us are very harsh, but it pushes us in the right direction to move forward living in trusting in the Lord. And so that's kind of the way we need to take Ecclesiastes. And also a warning that we can take the teacher's words too far. If we try to find the meaning of life and we kind of allow ourselves to be soaked in the crazy emotional trauma of finding the meaning of life, we're going to take that too far. And so we need to fear God, keep his commands, and that God is in control, and we need to trust in him. Ecclesiastes, also a very sad book of the Bible, because it's basically this person being like, everything is meaningless, it all sucks, and yeah. That's my section of the podcast. Well, Holly.
That was good.
Thank you.
Now I got the randos that aren't connected to anything, really.
Yeah, enjoy.
Thanks. Okay, so we got Esther. And Esther's a really good... I was telling Emma this earlier, that I read Esther a billion times, but this time it, like... I don't know, something about it just really stood out to me, but I can't really go into it because it's not a long book of the Bible, but there's a lot in it. But I won't talk about all of it. Anyways, okay, so Esther is set... The story is set 100 years after the Babylonian exile of the Jewish people, which we talked a lot about in the last episode of this podcast. And so some of the Jews returned to Jerusalem, like Ezra and Nehemiah, which we talk about in a minute. But many did not, and this book is about one of the Jewish communities that didn't go back to Jerusalem, and they're living in Susa, which is a Persian city. A random fact about this book is that God is never mentioned, not even once, which is really crazy.
But I also think it's really interesting, though, because it gives us, as a reader, an opportunity to find God working throughout the story. Mm-hmm. And instead of, because most of the books are just like, well, here's where God's working, this is what God says, this is this and that. But now we have the opportunity to find it for ourselves, which I think is really great. The main characters of this story is Esther, shocker, and Mordecai, the king of Persia, and Haman, which is like the villain of the story. So it opens with this banquet that the king is throwing, and it lasted 187 days, which I don't know about you, but I want to have a party for 187 days. I think I'd be really tired, but whatever. So the king got like super drunk. And I think it was the last day. He got really, really drunk. And he wanted his wife to come in and, like, parade herself around. Because, I don't know, she was, like, really hot or something. And he wanted to show her off. And she was like, no. And so he got mad and then got rid of her. And so now he needs a new wife. And so now the Book of Esther turns into, like, the Bachelor of the Bible. So you got, like, this man who is the king, and he brings in all these virgins who are, like, parading around their party, and he's basically throwing, like, a beauty pageant. And Esther enters this beauty pageant, but doesn't reveal that she's Jewish, which is important to the rest of the story, that he doesn't know that she's Jewish. And then she ends up winning, and he loves her so much, and is, like, obsessed with her that she's now, like, becomes the queen. So that's crazy. So then a bunch of really crazy stuff happens, and we don't really have time to get into it, but you need to go read Esther, because it's really good. But Haman, who we talked about earlier, gets super angry, and he persuades the king to destroy all the Jewish people. And there's this whole thing about the dice that he uses, mm-hmm. which is super fascinating to, like, the end of the story, but I won't talk about it. And so now they have, like, 11 months or something like that to try and figure out how to get the king to not destroy the Jewish people, and because Esther and Mordecai are basically the only hope for the people, they make a plan. And Esther's going to reveal her Jewish identity and ask the king to reverse the decree. But a really long story short, she risks it for the biscuit, and the king said he can't revoke the decree because of some law or whatever, but he can make a new one. And so he basically says that if you're Jewish, you're able to kill anyone that tries to kill you, and you can defend yourself and whatever. And so they did, and when the 11 months came, or were up, and the day came that all the Jews were supposed to be destroyed, the people that wanted to destroy them ended up dying, and the Jews were saved from destruction.
Yay!
Thus ends the story of Esther. But there's a lot more in there that you need to go back and read. I have, like, lots of notes, but you need to read it. Okay. Next up, we got the Book of Daniel.
Daniel
is a shorter book. It's only 12 chapters, but it's so good. And the problem with Daniel, well, it's not a problem, but the first half of the book are stories of Daniel and his friends, who we know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then the last half are stories of his Daniel has, like, visions and dreams and stuff, and most of it's, like, apocalyptic and all this other stuff. But we know that Daniel was the one that was thrown into the lion's den, mm-hmm. because he wouldn't worship the king, and we know that his friends were the ones that got thrown into the furnace because they didn't worship the king, but God saved all of them. And we love Daniel 3 because that's where my tattoo came from, mm-hmm. Daniel chapter 3.
Mm-hmm.
But those stories are really interesting, and you should go read them. Because it just really shows faithfulness and how much they love Jesus. Well, God. Chapter 7 starts the whole visions. And this is where we get the whole concept of God being the Ancient of Days. Comes from this chapter. Daniel sees four beasts. One's a lion, one's a bear, and one's like a leopard with wings. And then the other one is, they call, like, the super beast, kind of, and it's, like, the beast of all beasts that's going to, like, come and destroy everything. And he goes into this whole vision of what happens, and then there's God on his throne, but God's referred to as the Ancient of Days, and then the Son of Man comes, who we know as Jesus, and there's all this crazy stuff happens. And that's just in chapter 7, and the rest of the book are more visions that kind of add to it.
It's whack.
And it's really crazy. And I don't really understand it, so I'm not going to try to explain it, but maybe one day when I understand it, I'll explain it. So you should just read it and try and figure it out for yourself. The end of Daniel is still more dreams and things that he has. All right, now, Ezra and Nehemiah. They are, in our Bibles, two separate books, but originally they were actually written as one book.
Yes.
So we're going to refer to them as one book. This story is kind of set around the same time, that Esther was. It's set after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, which we talked about a lot. And then the Jews went to exile and all that jazz. But there's three key leaders who the focus is on through these two books. It's Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. I wonder why Zerubbabel wasn't chosen to get his own book, but well,
it's fine.
He basically is in charge of leading the group of Jews back to Jerusalem to rebuild it because it was destroyed. So now he took a group, and this is just bless you.
Thank you.
He takes a giant group back to Jerusalem, starts rebuilding like the temple and the city and all that jazz. And then 60 some years later, Ezra arrives on the scene, and he's like kind of the one that's like, he's a teacher and he loves the Torah, and so he's kind of in charge of teaching the Torah to the people and rebuilding the Jewish community within Jerusalem. So that's kind of his main focus. But then at the same time, Nehemiah's not quite there yet, because at the beginning of his book, it's actually very beautiful and you should go read it, but he has this really long prayer in chapter one of his book that's beautiful. I find myself going through that like as a prayer for myself. I just change a few words because I'm not going to build the wall of Jerusalem, but so I would encourage you to go read that because the beginning half of Nehemiah is really good. But he's in charge of, he ends up asking the king that he works for if he can go and rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and the king's like, okay, sure, go ahead. Also, here's a bunch of guards and a bunch of resources, a bunch of things that you can use to go do it. And so the Lord, you can really see the Lord's hand through the first half of Nehemiah, which is really cool. But then everyone was like doing really good, but then the people started to neglect the Torah and the covenant, which, you know, big shocker right there, because that's not a thing that we've seen over and over again. And Nehemiah starts to go a little bit crazy out of his frustration towards the people, and he starts like beating people up and pulling out their hair, and he's just yelling at everyone saying like, you really need to obey the Torah because y'all are whack and you really need to be doing these things. And literally the book ends with him just saying, well, I tried, God remember me, and that's it. That's how the book ends, which is
woohoo. Whatever. Yeah,
good job, Nehemiah, at least you tried. Okay. Next, we got the Chronicles. Every time I think of this, I think of the Chronicles of Narnia.
I do too.
Which has nothing to do with what's in this book, but it's fine. All right.
Gosh.
Chronicles. We have in our Bible Chronicles 1 and 2, but we're referring to them as the Chronicles because they're actually just one thing. Why do they do that? I don't understand. Never mind. Okay. The first section of Chronicles, chapters 1 through 9, is nothing but genealogies, which is very boring for us, but actually,
it's very interesting.
It's very interesting if you read them. So you should probably do that. But the one thing I found that was super interesting, and it comes into play in the book of Esther, is that the purpose of genealogies for a lot of people is, like, as they're going through these names, it's bringing up, like, stories of what had happened. And so, let's see. The genealogies that were named in Chronicles is, like, all of the key characters in the stories that we have already read about. And stories that we don't know, but it's really used in, like, families to, like, let's read this. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I remember when that happened or whatever. And so that's kind of cool. And Esther talks about that, because the king has someone read it to him when he can't sleep. Maybe you can read me Chronicles when I can't sleep tonight.
Okay.
Okay, so Chronicles is very identical to Samuel and the Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hebrew Bible ends with Chronicles because it's like a refresher of Jewish scripture. So a lot of the important stories that are in First and Second Chronicles, and so especially David, a lot of David stuff is in there. And so they kind of put it at the end as like a, well, now because of all of this, let's remember these things that happened. And so that's why it's at the end. Let's see. There's the author of Chronicles, which we don't know who the author is, but he kind of is emphasizing two of the key lineages with the genealogies, and one being the Messianic king, which is started with Judah and ends with King David, but it doesn't really end with King David because we now know that Jesus continued on with the genealogy, mm-hmm. but we didn't know that then. And then the second one is the priesthood, which is the descendants of Aaron, and then all of them ended up serving in the temple, so that's really interesting. And then chapters 10 through 29 are just stories about David. And what's really interesting about this is that he leaves out all of the bad stories about David. So we don't know anything, like, with Bathsheba and all of that. Like, none of that's ever brought up again. It's only the positive stories are found and some new stories that we haven't heard before.
I talked about this with my Old Testament professor. We, like, talked about it as a class when we were studying this last year. But it was, like, I think it was 1st and 2nd Samuel where David is also, like, portrayed a lot. Like, he's in that a lot, right? More so than Kings. It was almost like the author of 1st and 2nd Samuel was open about everything that happened with David, and then the Chronicles were just advocating for David. Not to erase the bad things, but to be like, well, look at all the things that David has done. Like, look at all the great, cool, awesome things about David, to kind of push him to, like, I don't know, because he is, like, in the Messianic line, to kind of, like, be like, this is why he deserves to be in the Messianic line. So,
yes.
Yeah,
which I was going to get to.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know that.
But you just answered it. So
I'm sorry, I didn't.
No, it's okay. Yeah, so kind of the reason we think that he was portrayed that way is because he...
Sorry, David, you were going to go into that.
The image of the future Messianic king, which is prophesied in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. They refer to the coming Messiah, who we know as Jesus, as the new David.
Yeah.
So that is why we only hear positive things about David. So Emma was very correct about that one. You don't need to apologize. And then Second Chronicles is just about more kings in Jerusalem. It only focuses on the kings that came from the line of David, though, which is still kind of has to do with the Messianic line. And it highlights the kings that are obedient to God and talks about how their obedience led to success and God's blessing, which we see throughout the whole Bible, that if you are obeying the Lord, like, he's going to bless you in that. And so they talk about the kings who do that. And then they also talk a little bit about the unfaithful kings so that later generations will learn, like, what will happen if you're not faithful to the Lord. And the one thing that's really interesting about the last book of the Torah is that it ends in an incomplete sentence. It literally says, whoever is among us, among you, of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. And that's it. They don't finish the sentence. Let him go up where?
Aggravating.
Where are we going? Let him go up to heaven? Let him go up to the tree? I don't know.
Yeah. That's very interesting because our Old Testament ends with Malachi, which is prophesying Jesus, and so with our Bibles, they, like, we end on a hopeful note and a hopeful tone to wait for the Savior, but their Bible ends with incompletion.
Yep.
And they're like, bro, what the dumb do I do now? Which I think is really cool. And so that's your crash course on the Ketuvim. But why is this all important? Like, why do we need to know about this Ketuvim? Like, it's, again, part of the Old Testament. Well, a lot of these scriptures are scriptures for us to hold on to. There are stories of people like Job who have gone through horrible seasons of life and still trusted God that we can look up to, and we are going through our horrible seasons of life, and we can look to God. It also gives us the space, like in Psalms and Ecclesiastes and Lamentations, to sit before God with our turmoil and wrestle with him. And also just present what is going on within us and present him, all of our thoughts and feelings, and just to kind of be in that state of vulnerability. We have people like Daniel who just constantly trust in the Lord, to provide and to protect, that we get to follow and understand. And also all of this history about how God redeemed and restored, like in Ezra, Nehemiah, and the Chronicles. And so this is all stuff to hold on to. It's prayers that we get to use in our own life. And it's also important, kind of like we've reiterated over and over again, that if he did it for them, he's going to do it for us. And so these books are super important for us to study so we can understand who God is and how he flows in and out of every single person's life and how he is there in the midst of every single season. And it also is just a diverse place where lots of emotions are being expressed that we sometimes get too afraid to express before God. So I don't want to talk much longer because that was a lot of information being thrown at you. This is almost an hour long. But it's a lot of information that I hope you are able to learn so much about the books, the Bible, that we don't normally like to touch. So that is the end of the Old Testament.
Yay, we did
Look
it.
Look at us go. The end of the Tanakh. And so starting next week, we're going to get into the Gospels, which is a lot more familiar territory, I think, for all of us. So it'll be lots of less of commentary and book research and things like that for Holly and I, but just more comfortable information, I feel like, for all of us, that is really important because we get to meet the character of Jesus and who he is more explicitly than kind of hidden in the text in these. So yeah, I think that's all. Do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
I have to pee.
Okay, Holly has to pee. With all that being said, I'm Emma.
I'm Holly.
We'll catch you on the flippity flap.
We did it that time.
We did it good.